Hey, welcome to Info Under the Radar, the show where we talk with an expert to simplify everyday ideas, concepts, and subjects that surround us. Hello, and welcome to yet another normal episode of Info Under the Radar. We know we have been on a tad bit of a break and we released a shorter episode prior, but we have something special in store for you. I'm your host, Devendra.
And I'm Vishwajit.
So for this episode, we are planning to seep into your mentality of how do you use your wallet. We have invited one of the most loved professors from our bachelor's college, Professor A.P. Singh, and we are going to talk and possibly understand about finance, investing, financial institutions in general at a very fundamental or first principle level. And from someone who has all the credibilities and all the experience from a national, international, and intergenerational perspective. So I am personally very excited to share this conversation with you. But before beginning that, Vishwajit, in general, what is your idea of money per se? Like, what is your relationship with it?
Yeah, it's funny that we also asked this question to the professor as well. Mm-hmm. To be very honest, coming from a place where money was definitely not available in abundance,
yeah,
I still never cared too much about money. Like, I mean, you know me since many years. Like, if I enjoy something, I like to spend money on that. I just never, maybe up to a fault sometimes, to mm-hmm. if I have to be honest. But for me, money is not something you just like pile upon, but rather something which you used for, yeah, of course, safety, let's say.
Uh-huh.
It can be mental, psychological safety, so to speak.
Some assurance,
of course. And it can even include like physical safety if we talk right. about insurance, et cetera, et cetera. But then also using money as a tool, or Professor A.P. Singh said, as a vehicle for mm-hmm. me, for things which brings joy to me. So to yeah. me, it's ultimately a tool which I use to bring joy to me.
I would take an opportunity to highlight the point that it's not just the lack of money in general while growing up, but also money in general, owning a lot of it or abundance of it is seen as more of a vice than a virtue in Indian culture. So yeah. in general, that tames our relationship with money as we grow up in a very different way. So we talk about, as you already mentioned, how Sir's relationship has been, and I'll mention it at this point that during the conversation too, we refer to him as Sir because we are kind of used to it, to calling our professors by the name of Sir or Ma'am back in India.
In general, for any teacher, yeah. it's considered respectful to yeah. call them Sir or Ma'am.
So other than that, answering what is his relationship with money, he paints a very clear picture of understanding the whole spectrum of what is your income, money, expenditure, where does insurance lie in it, how to think of investment. And so that whenever you're thinking about it in your own room and you have a pen and paper, it would help you draw the picture out more clearly.
I think on top of that, we even talked about sort of this idea of early retirement.
True.
And how he see it. It's almost funny that yeah. for him, yeah, like, why would you even need an early retirement? Uh-huh. So it was very interesting to see that how he see it, both from a generational point of view, to be mm-hmm. honest, but also as someone who see money more as a vehicle than anything else. So which yeah. I really, really liked, which is opposite to like how I think about money in some ways. So that would be very interesting for some of you to listen how someone like him kind of don't agree necessarily with the idea of retiring early, which is becoming like a cool thing to do,
uh-huh.
at least in our generation, I yeah. guess.
And also because, of course, he has his reasons and definitions of what retirement means to him.
Yeah, so, totally. And yeah. I think he comes in from a test cricket point of view. So why am I mentioning this? Because he has used some cricket analogies. I mean, mm-hmm. he's a big cricket fan, not just he's a cricket fan. Actually, some people in his family end up playing for India, mm-hmm. which is a really, really big deal.
Yeah.
If you are not aware about cricket, your loss, first of all. As an avid cricket lover, I can say that. But more importantly, if you don't know about cricket and if you are aware about baseball, let's say that's like sort of like the close analogy.
But better.
But better. And I'm pretty sure all our Indian audience and other nations where cricket has been played, they are really hating us for comparing it to baseball. But in short, yeah, he used a lot of his, not a lot, but some, let's say, cricket analogy, true to his way of teaching also back in university as well.
Yeah. And in general, during the conversation, what we enjoyed the most was the way he thinks of the things, the way he has even conducted the classes. We both have been his students at one point in time. So it's very reflective of his experience. He, and not just experience as a professor or as an industry veteran, but rather someone who has experienced traveling across the world, working with various colleagues in a time when it wasn't that common. Like we're talking about 80s and 90s, where going to different countries and working wasn't as normal for a regular Indian person, at least, if I say so. So his experience is very evident on that regard.
I think talking about his experience, so I just to give a better idea of his bio.
Yeah.
So basically he has played, like, so to speak, two long innings. And people who are, again, familiar with cricket, they might know in test cricket, we have two innings usually. So his first big innings was in banking and finance. So he was a general manager as head of international funding for ICICI Limited for close to 30 years. And if you don't know about ICICI, it is top four banks in India. And when he was working, ICICI was working very closely with World Bank, and his job involved working with various international banking institutions. So he has a lot of experience looking at money also from a cultural point of view. And we end up also discussing, like, how, for example, in our limited experience here in Germany, how people see and perceive money here versus, let's say, in India or in US or any other place. So that has been like a big part of his work in the finance and banking industry. And we are really minimizing by just saying one line. He has done extremely important work, let's say. And then since 2006, I think he has been professor at LNM IIT or Lakshmi Niwas Mittal Institute of Information Technology, which is the university where me and Devendra both did their bachelor's. And basically, if you don't know, this university actually comes from Lakshmi Mittal, who is owner and CEO of ArcelorMittal, one of the richest dudes in the world. And maybe football fans know ArcelorMittal. Yeah, so basically, he is the professor in our university since the beginning, I guess. And on top of that, he has also done MBA when MBA was not at all common, like in the 70s or 80s. And part of his MBA, he also spent some time in Wharton, which many of you know is like one of the best business institutions in the world.
So that should be enough to just give a brief idea of the credibility sir happened to have. And we sure that we are still not doing justice to what his experience or what his credibilities are. Yeah. One thing that I would like to mention at this point is that during the course of the conversation, occasionally you would see some Hindi phrases or words sprinkled here and there. They don't take away any value out of a non-Hindi speaker, but they just add a bit of a light-hearted jokiness here and there if you already speak Hindi. But it won't take away any value if you do not speak that.
And besides that, I think there has been sort of usage of word Western versus Indian context many a times, because as we all know, money and finance, insurance, et cetera, varies a lot with culture and a region. So he has used Western very loosely. So we totally understand Western world is pretty big, you know, even within, for example, EU, where a lot of countries have same currency, which is euro, still have a very different relationship for a normal person with money or, you know, savings or whatever you want to call it. So don't take it too literally when he or we are using the word Western. We totally understand. It's a very subjective thing. So we just wanted to mention that.
And on that front, there is also an abbreviation that has been used, which is a very India-specific term, more often than not, which is LIC, Life Insurance Corporation. life insurance in general is an umbrella term under which in your own country, you might be finding something called as health insurance or liability insurance. These all sometimes more often than not could be considered under that umbrella term.
I just want to say that the biggest learning for us was not just looking at investment or money from like, okay, we have $1,000. How can we just invest it? But rather looking at a deeper meaning of the money itself. And I think that's something what Professor APS mentioned a lot, like an understanding that how it might vary for person to person based on where they are in their life. And on based on that, his suggestions may or may not apply to you. So again, it's a finance related episode. So we just want to mention that don't take anything literally, and it's not a financial specific advice.
Yeah. Correct. The overarching theme of this entire conversation is the what's. Like, what exactly is an insurance, or where does it fall, and what is an investment, and like, how should you think of it in general, not how you should invest, where you should invest, or the fine points or the nitty-gritties of it. But the what's are something that we intend to convey properly. And talking about what's, what exactly are you doing if you haven't followed us on our social media yet, which is @theRateInfoUnderTheRadar on Instagram, @theRateInfoUnderRadar on Twitter, and trusting the mother algorithm on YouTube, just search Info Under the Radar, and hopefully you'd see two Apple emoticon faces popping up on your first page of the result.
So without further ado, let's welcome Professor AP Singh, or as we lovingly like to call him, APS.
Hi, sir. Welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to see you. To set up the context a bit, you probably would already know it, but you might not agree to it, that you are one of the most loved professors from the bachelor's college that we have. And it's been one of the most enjoyable experiences in general to talk with you in the class while making presentations, and in general, when you invite us for lunch and stuff. So this is one sort of conversation. This is one topic that we have been wanting to explore in general. And then we couldn't think of any better guest than you. So thank you first so much for taking out time and doing this with us. But how are you doing in general with all the like chaos and everything going on around you?
Thanks, first of all, for inviting me to this little discussion. Let's hope it will be as much fun as we've had in class. And maybe one of the reasons that you enjoyed all those sessions, all that suffering, is because we never ran them like classes, right? Yeah. It was always a game of cricket, or we were having fun together. So hopefully that is what might have endeared you to these classes.
But okay, where does this come from, sir? Like, I'm just curious, out of curiosity, because we take, I don't know, however many, like hundreds of hours of classes during 4 years of my undergrad, and I remember distinctly your classes were so much different, just the sheer approach. Of course, there are subjects which cannot be made that fun, unfortunately, but even like courses which you taught, a lot of other professors taught the same courses, but your approach seemed to be very, very different. Where does that come from? Like
perhaps it comes, as I often joke, from the fact that I've not been a teacher. So I was not constrained by whatever are the concepts of, you know, teaching. I always looked at the students as my customers or as, you know, young people joining the team, and I had to get them on board. They all are talented, so there's no need to tell them what shots to play. But getting across the attitude, getting across that energy, getting across that little coming together are the elements that I always emphasized from the very first batch. And I still remember when I first joined and had to address Bio3, and I went to our director, then Professor Sinha, and said, "Sir, you know, can you help me structure the course?" He said, "But the content is something that you must have got." I said, "Yeah, I have the content, but I've never done a course. So how do I structure it?" And Professor Sinha said, "Well, in IIT Kanpur," I said, "Sir, I'm sorry, I have no idea of IIT Kanpur." He said, "And I have no idea of your content. So how can I guide you?" So basically, I discovered very quickly that I was at the deep end of the pool and I had to learn how to swim.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, YO3 was luckily only 29 students. So it was a nice, small, compact class, a lot of interaction, a lot of energy. And I began to play with them as if these were newcomers into ICICI. And I had done a fair bit of training sessions for young people who had joined. So, you know, I kind of tweaked that model. And I told the students, I want constantly, you know, for you to tell me how this is working. And then I had Professor Tomer sit in a few classes for me, especially when the teams were making presentations. Mind you, this was a class of 29, so teams were of 2 or 3 only.
Mm-hmm.
But I made Professor Tomer sit through those presentations, partly also to get his sense of what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him at the end of the class saying, I've thoroughly enjoyed this because I've never seen this atmosphere anywhere in class. So, and of course, Professor Tomer came also from a working background. So he understood when I told him what is the experiment I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how that experiment has rolled on.
Interesting. We covered a lot of things in those presentations and the way you conduct classes. But there's one question that I've always been wanting to ask you, but I never really got a good premise to ask that. So I'll use this stage as an opportunity for now. So you have seen, like you also mentioned briefly, that you've seen both the ends of the pool in one way, like once where you had a long career in banking, so you understand the basics of finance, and now it comes about imparting that knowledge to the next generation. But personally, for your own self, the overarching theme of this, what has been your own personal relationship with money, or how has it been evolving over the years in general?
Oh, well, money, of course, we all relate to money in any case as users of money.
Mm-hmm.
What I got thrust into is a job where we had to understand money as an instrument of activity, economic activity. And having joined what was a bank, although not a commercial bank, it was a wholesale bank that gave loans to only industry. And primarily the purpose was for us to be as a conduit to foreign currency funding for projects in India.
Mm-hmm.
So 1950s is when ICICI was set up. Even the World Bank was still very young, and India itself as a country was young. So experimentation was happening. And India had already announced, Nehruji had announced this commanding heights. So certain sectors of the economy would be governed, owned by the government. So particularly, you know, your mining sector and stuff like that, where resources were what they were. But banking and insurance and stuff technically was in the private sector even then.
All right.
And his idea was that private sector simultaneously must be allowed to grow. And when you say private sector, primarily you mean the industrial sector. And that's where we needed to import a lot of equipment and machines from abroad, and India didn't have the foreign currency.
Mm-hmm.
So ICICI was part of a larger World Bank plan for the whole world and countries where they were helping. And they had set up similar ICICIs in several countries, Korea, South Korea, Thailand, Japan, even Japan, because Japan was still coming out of war at that time and was an underdeveloped country.
Mm-hmm.
So ICICI was one of maybe 20 or 25 such institutions World Bank had decided to set up, which would be kind of clones of the World Bank. And World Bank would channelize their assistance to private sector through these clones. So we were trained at the World Bank about assessing projects and how to go about it and so many other criteria, etc. And the World Bank also became the primary supplier of that foreign currency in the initial years. The expectation was India will gradually grow up and markets will begin to open up and we'll be able to go internationally and raise money on our own, which of course we did, starting in the 70s and especially in the 80s, 90s, we had a bit of a hiccup with our own economy. And soon after that, of course, once the 91-94 reform started, then we were also the first company to list our shares on the New York Stock Exchange. So that's as deep as you can go into the world of commercial finance abroad.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, that was a part of learning about money, which was thrust on me when I had to learn that on the job. And my role almost throughout my career in ICICI happened to be on the borrowing side. That means raising money abroad.
All right.
So that got me into a lot more nuances as markets themselves were also still growing. Today, it might look like, oh, the world markets and stock markets are all fine. But in the 70s, foreign currencies were still being opened up. Systems were evolving. There were so many things happening on the international currency front. And one was in the, you know, right there in the front seat, having to take all of this. So the learning curve was very steep.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gave me a tremendous exposure to different styles of working and managing and in different countries. You know, you could, after a while, after a few years, I still remember there were some people who had come to make a presentation. And a colleague was sitting next to me. So I wasn't invited to this. His team was really doing all of this. So when the speaker was speaking, I said, oh, he's Irish. I said, and he's probably studied in London and all of that. And then, you know, we had their biodata in the, when he did that, he discovered all of this was true. So he's looking at me wondering, how did you figure out? So it was just that, you know, having met them and seen them and heard them so often, one had become adept at even knowing, you know, what kind of background so-and-so was coming from, which was always very helpful because when you were negotiating with them, to know how they are going to play. So when you are bowling, you know where to pitch it because you know how he's batting. So all that helped. And it was you know, as I said, it was growing on the job.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So sir, until now you mentioned like how you were observing money and how you were learning about money. We would be also curious to know how is your interaction with money itself look like, let's say in your personal life?
Well, what happens is, of course, money is even more than the spoken language. So we might be speaking a common language to communicate, which is English.
Mm-hmm.
But there can be so many more languages. But as far as doing transactions between human beings is concerned, money is the only language.
So like
I would look at money in finance more as a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is using that vehicle for a certain purpose, to go from point A to point B. So for example, if you look at the relationship to money for any individual,
mm-hmm.
and pardon me for putting it on a very, very wide
uh-huh.
scale, but philosophically, all of us as human beings are transitory on this planet. So our primary question is, what the hell am I doing here? And one way to put it is, I'm running a relay race. So my parents gave me the baton, brought to a certain point in time, from where I am now running till I pass it on to my children.
Mm-hmm.
And generationally, this is what has been happening over time. Mm-hmm. Only thing is, the human being is not satisfied with merely repeating something. At every stage, there is an attempt to incrementally improve. So applying the same logic, I would say money becomes an expression of my having run my part of the relay race correctly.
A,
did I preserve what my parents passed on to me? Have I added incremental value when I'm passing it on to my children?
Mm-hmm.
For them to then take off from there, even if vertically. Mm-hmm. Every parent likes their children to take off vertically.
Mm-hmm.
So that philosophy of life with money being the primary, as I said, vehicle or language of everything that we do and evaluate, I would say our approach to money should be from that point of why is money important to me? Who am I in this whole game? What do I have to actually do? I have a sense of responsibility for sure. And how do I go about fulfilling this primary purpose of taking the baton, adding value and passing it on? So if my job is only to bring that incrementality, that delta value, then it's a question of how do I optimally manage my pace during my lifetime so that I'm able to add as much value as I can.
While keeping that all in mind, has like the idea of being financially free or financially liberated has been at the top of your head while you were working towards it?
There are two ways I'll answer that. First is, as an individual, of course, each of us, even if our parents have financed our education, I've spoken to many of you and I often get this answer. My first priority is I want to pay off the debt that my father has created.
Correct.
And then of course, move on and look at incremental value.
Mm-hmm.
So financial independence of that kind, not independence. I am looking to be the driver of that money for the family. I'm not jettisoning my family.
Mm-hmm.
In the Western world, independence means I have nothing to do with my parents anymore.
Okay.
And therefore, the word independence has a very strong emotional value to a Westerner. We in India are looking at this as interdependence. Our parents are going to be with us forever.
Mm.
We even expect our children to be with us forever.
True. Yeah.
So the cultural approach to the problem statement is different. Am I looking for financial independence in an Indian family? Or am I looking to add to the kitty? In the Western context, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now going to college, which means parents are out of the picture. And what is closely related to that is another phenomenon which is widely different between the West and countries like India. When they wash their hands off their parents in the hope of independence, what they're losing is the dependence on the family kitty. After all, who have parents made this for?
Mm-hmm.
In India, the concept is always bachon ke liye.
Mm-hmm.
In the Western world, that is expectation is not there, but that is an aspiration parents have.
Mm-hmm.
But independence therefore means you are giving up the dependence on some capital that the family has to be able to do a few things. And you substitute that with debt. So the per capita debt in the Western world is, I don't know how many times, maybe 10, if not more times, greater than the personal debt of an individual in India. So independence, we need to look at as not the same connotation, how you are looking at it. As I said, if you go back to the basics,
mm-hmm.
My job here is to add incremental value. By the way, as humanity, that is true even intellectually. We are the only species which is able to pass on intellectual capital.
Mm-hmm.
A cheetah will run, will be trained briefly, will see its parent run and learn how to run. And it will catch up with that speed of the parent, but there's no improvement on that speed. It's only the human being which is finding ways to improve even on something which evolution doesn't allow that degree of change. But 100 years ago, we ran 100 meters at 12 seconds. And today the record is 9.5.
Mm-hmm.
So evolutionary, we couldn't have changed physically that much to have clipped so much. It's all a question of using our intellectual capital, building on somebody else's experiment, taking on from there. So, you know, like you're always going upwards. So the same thing is true also of financial capital. If my main job is to add to the kitty, if my children don't want it, that's their lookout. That doesn't mean my job is not to look after them. My job is here. I have a certain head start. Yes, my parents have a certain base of capital. Of that, some part is available to me. I can use that also judiciously. And yet, I need to bring my incremental value, which is obviously, quote unquote, my independent addition to the family kitty. So if we approach money and finance that way, it gives you a different dimension to your relationship with money.
So let me rephrase the question a bit here, because although some of the points you said are correct, but I also see the way, at least I could be wrong, our generation see money, and you talked about the family kitty part, has been changing dramatically, to be super honest, in my opinion. I think now the approach a lot of people who I see, at least in my circle, could be true for your circle as well, Devin, like there, that has been changing, because now if you look at, like if I look at myself, the probability of me living with my parents is very low. Like if I have to be very realistic here, right? That does not mean I don't care about them. And there is a big financial aspect of it I do think about, but that has been changing, and that changes the financial aspect of it. And to me, and also just to give counter argument of Western world removing their hand, I have actually experienced completely opposite. Like I have friends here who's, yes, there is a sense of independence, but then there are families, they are buying houses together, which is ultimately is for the kid, but then parents are still putting in the money, which is very similar to what a lot of Indian parents like to do that as well. So I think ultimately it comes down to parent caring about children, which might look different, of course, for an Indian or for a German to an Indian context, but ultimately we are all looking for safety and, you know, happiness, so to speak, in terms of that. Now, having said that, now my question will be, now in our generation, people are talking a lot about retiring early, let's say. So meaning traditionally, for example, if someone is listening in India, they think about retirement at 60, 62, if their parents are in, let's say, government job or in any public service, right? Because private jobs don't necessarily have retirement age back in India. But in Germany, everyone has a retirement age. For example, like 67, I think, is the current retirement age. But now our generation, but let's say subset of our generation, I should say, is thinking about retiring early, which means you can say financial independence, financial liberty, however people want to define it. It's about retiring, let's say, at 45 or 50, which does not mean they don't want to work, but they might want to just, you know, have enough money to maybe live off of. I'm not sure. What is your thought about that? Do you think that pursuing that idea is even worth it? First of all, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I'm struggling with the word independence. Independence from what? We are all interdependent. The whole life, we are interdependent. So if you are working for a company, even if you work to retirement age, it's not like you are a slave. You are making a contribution. You are getting paid for something. You are getting professional enjoyment in doing something. So,
sorry to interrupt, but not to work for that company
or retire, what independence does that really mean?
Here you are assuming that people are enjoying the work. That's not always the case, first of all.
That's a very different game. retirement is not a panacea for happiness.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't be happy doing what you are doing, you know, to run away from it and think independent somewhere else and I'm going to get happiness, I think that's a misnomer.
Mm.
Also, your idea...
Happiness is a function of enjoying what you do. So if you enjoy what you do, and you put your whole life behind it, that's fine.
But sir, sometimes you cannot make money out of it, right? Let's say, for example, I get my sheer happiness if I am climbing the mountains, but there is not a lot of money to make out of it. I mean, someone can say, yeah, you can be a sponsored athlete, but that's only very one, like 0.1% of all the people who do climbing. So some jobs where people do, or some activities which people do, really find their deeper happiness. So when I say happiness, their deep enjoyment, but that does not mean they can do that financially. And that's where this idea of retiring early comes from, that, hey, I will make enough money so that my children can still go to school, but I don't necessarily have to sit 9 to 5 in a job, which I may or may not enjoy.
Okay. I mean, I'm still struggling with that, because if you are that impatient with something that I can understand, you don't like a job, you switch a job, you do something else.
All right.
But okay. I mean, retirement is an extreme. I can understand retirement is when you think you put in your best, you already created whatever you had to do, you made that bit, and you know, this is it. But as you rightly said, obviously at that younger age, you don't really retire. You just switch. Instead of working for a company, you work for yourself. When you say you work for yourself, you are working for your company. You are different from your company. You are responsible to your company, just as you were responsible to the company that you were working for earlier. So what independence from whom? You're not going to be independent from your responsibility of creating incremental value during your lifetime.
But we are talking about independence from making money, let's say. So let's say if right now, for example, to be on the same page. So for example, let's say if I am earning a certain amount, right? And if I stopped earning that amount 3 months from now on, and I don't have any other job to do, I won't be able to afford my flat. I won't be able to pay off whatever insurance I'm taking or investment or able to even enjoy my life. So that's where the idea comes from. What if that problem does not exist? So independence from those worries where you still don't have a job, but still have maybe enough money to survive off of. At least that's how I look at it. People might have a very different definition of, you know, independence. That's how I look at
it. If you'll allow me to just create one little time frame, and then we can take the discussion from there.
Sure.
See, what happens is you people are now have gotten into the stride of, you know, being bread earners. So you are beginning to feel that first sense of responsibility towards what you are earning. Now, classically, when people, you know, plan, if you are talking about retirement, so let us assume, okay, theoretically it is possible. But what is the time frame and what is the structure over which you will judge whether you have hit that break-even point where you can walk away? So what happens is you are in your 20s and you know you create a timeline into 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Your key career span. And look at three things. One is your income flow. So what is my income that will come? So you fill in the figures over there, whatever estimates you want. Just below that will come what are going to be my kind of expenditure. So expenditure in Germany will be different from expenditure in India.
Right.
But now put a stream of what is it, how much money will I need out of what I'm earning to spend, because that is my daily living. I cannot avoid it. Then this minus this gives me my savings. And it's then a question of how do I allocate my savings. In that second line of expenditure, what you will have to do is to put down certain buckets in which expenditure is going to happen. Marriage, children, children's education, higher education, parents' health. Remember, unlike in the Western world where people are either insured or everything is on the government. So, you know, that is not even part of your
right
arithmetic. Whereas here, that will have to be also part of the arithmetic depending on circumstances. So, creating these buckets gives you a sense of at which time will I need how much money. Some of them will come in buckets, certain years in which schooling, certain years in which this, that, etc., their marriage, children's marriage, etc. So they'll come in buckets. Secondly, it'll give you a timeline to it. So once you plot perhaps that second line first, these are my responsibilities. Till I fulfill these responsibilities, there is no independence.
Correct.
Now, what happens in the line one? My income level. So my income level will also move up. But what can I do to tweak that to make sure my savings buckets are growing? Initially, your savings bucket will be tiny. Over time, these will grow. So your capital will grow as you go along, which you will need to allocate into whatever kinds of investments, for which your investment managers will be better judges to fine-tune exactly your need. But each of us will need to work these three lines, and it is that largeness of that safety bucket which will then tell you, okay, this is where I can call it.
That's a very excellent way to, at least for me, to visualize what you meant. And you mentioned this bucket analogy and talking about increasing the savings bucket, and then saving in turn take us to this world of investment. So let's say, assuming someone who is listening to us, and I include myself into that, who have very limited idea about investment. Of course, we have certain type of investment when we are sitting in 2021, right? Like traditional stocks and bonds. We can also even include gold in that if we want. Mm-hmm. Then we have property, right? Like owning a house, owning a summer house, et cetera, et cetera. And then these digital new age type of investment, sort of cryptocurrencies, if you like, or ICOs or whatever. So if you have to explain to someone like me, who knows very little about, let's say, in the world of investment, how should they come about that? Let's say, how should they start approaching their investment?
Okay. Primarily, what happens is all financial instruments can be distributed in, broken down into two categories. What are called financial or so-called liquid, and others which are non-financial. So non-financial are typically chunky ones, such as real estate, gold, jewelry, artwork, antiques, paintings.
Fancy collection of shoes and watches.
These all go into a different category of investment. The financial, the one which is running through the markets system, you broadly will, your fund advisor, you'll need one for sure, will tell you that. Primarily, there are going to be two categories of investments, either equity or debt. Now, all of investment, if you go on the investment side, as you can see, is a trade-off between risk and return. Mm-hmm. So high risk, high return, low risk, low return. Everybody is kind of praying low risk and high return. That's wishful thinking. If that happens, a lottery or something happens, you cannot plan for it.
Yeah,
true.
And therefore, you know, a lot of people who make mistakes and who get greedy or who misread how to make investments usually suffer from this problem. Assuming low risk and high return is possible. Possible, yes, but the probability is so low that the moment you find something that looks low risk and high return, you've got to find somebody with a nose who can smell it and tell you, don't touch this.
Mm.
All traps, all your
Ponzi schemes and stuff.
Yeah, Ponzi schemes are all on that lure. So investments in two categories. One is these chunky types, which are a personal preference. Yes, you know, somebody might look at, and what is the main aim, by the way? The main aim is incremental value, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I put in 100 at the end of the year, do I get 100? Do I get less than 100? Do I get more than 100? Obviously, nobody wants less than 100. So what is that less than 100? If I do nothing with this money and put it in my cupboard or under my pillow, then something is going to eat it up. What is that?
Inflation.
Inflation is a negative impact on money. So to begin with, you're always running ahead of yourself to make sure your return is above inflation. Otherwise, you're losing money. So that is the primary stage at which you look at incrementally. Then it's a question of, okay, what else can I do? What can get me better return than a very, very safe fixed deposit in a bank? That is very safe, but it earns me very low return. Yes, sometimes it might even earn me less than inflation. So what happens is, stock markets always look more exciting for the simple reason the stock market comprises that population of investors who are hitting risk. Companies are in the business of creating models by which they are able to bring higher value addition. But risk is also there, of course.
Yeah.
And therefore, to look at only one side of the equation is dangerous. And then it then boils down to, when you go to stock markets and things, how do I balance that risk-reward ratio? One is, it's a function of my appetite. Oh, at this age, just now, when I've just got married, already a child, I can't be taking risks. So it's like in cricket. Oh, just now these five overs, I better just see through. Then I'll see. So your own reference to how you want to optimize your investments itself is a function of your time preferences and what is happening at that time. But that is the two broad categories in which these investments will go.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, what has now happened is, increasingly world over, mutual funds.
Yeah.
Is one way by which you avoid that, say, famous problem. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. That is the first golden rule of finance. No matter how safe it looks, don't put all your eggs in one basket. So you're constantly looking at diversifying your portfolio with these multiple objectives in mind, and you're constantly iterating that on your requirement, needs, income flow. The aim is best incremental value, but your judgment of best incremental value will change with circumstances.
While growing up, maybe it was just my family or people around me, that there were certain sort of investments that were considered good. Like, we are talking about late 1990s, early 2000s, that fixed deposit used to be the thing. Buying gold used to be the thing. Maybe buying a plot to make a house if you have enough money. However, whenever it came to investing in the stock market, I have heard my parents or my uncles and aunts say that it's a gamble. But nowadays, that has normalized more. Like, people in my age are investing more into stocks in whatever capacity they can. Do you think with this current changing of the financial scenario in general, making a fixed deposit or buying some sort of a house is even a worthwhile investment in today's day and age? Would you recommend that to someone like us?
You have to do the arithmetic.
Mm-hmm.
What are we trying to do? Objective is constant incremental value. If you think real estate is going to jump at a rate much higher than inflation, then it might be an option. So in countries like India, land is always considered still very privy because of pressure of land and people, etc. So real estate, there are people who invest in real estate. But again, just investing in real estate per se is not one single category. There are a whole spectrum.
Correct.
There are people who do it, they buy and sell every year. They're making money. It's a trading thing.
Right.
Like your traders on the stock market, they are not putting their money. They're using money and make. So those are traders. For somebody who's making a lifelong investment, you decide, okay, this plot, this place, this looks fine. I'm not going to touch it for 10 years. In 10 years, definitely value will go up. No matter by, I can't assume what percent, but it'll be definitely higher than inflation. So basically, when you're making those judgments or calls, there is some arithmetic in the head. Now, your parents saw prices of land, saw prices of gold. They could relate to that. They could see trends. Stock market, you have to watch the screen all the time. Your parents don't have the capacity to do that. Even you don't have the capacity.
Also not the resources as well at that time.
Resources is not the question. We are talking in percentages.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I can afford 10% of my income to invest in this, 10% of whatever your absolute amount. We're saying 10%. So, okay, on 10%, I can afford to lose this 10%. Then I can go for high risk, high return. But if, you know, just because that works well, I start suddenly putting 20, 30, 40, 50, disaster. Asking for trouble, right?
True.
So, percentages wise, when you decide how much you want to put over there, it's a question of saying, okay, when I'm putting it in stock market, if I put it in a single stock, I will have to watch the screen to know what is happening to this company. I'll have to figure out what is happening behind the scenes in this company. I don't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
That is where the mutual funds have come up. So what you do is you are buying a fraction of a large investment in several companies, which a fund manager is managing on behalf of all the investors. Of course, they're charging a fee, but they're giving you a return which the time required for you to manage that return would have been impossible.
Correct.
So that's where mutual funds come into play, pension funds, and these are a longer end segment of that same investable funds coming from that same buckets, as I said, at the bottom, savings. So each has a different property, a different purpose for which you can take it.
Mm-hmm.
And you make your own assessment apart from what your fund manager guides you with. I mean, you end up paying him a fee, but at least till you get the confidence you can manage it on your own. At least that's your insurance premium, right? We buy insurance of things where we don't know how to control the risk. So we're willing to pay a certain premium to avoid a significant risk in the future.
Right.
So similarly, you pay a fee to avoid the downside of that risk-reward ratio. And what they also say, stock markets, after all, for whatever they are, it's a long-term churning. And therefore, you do your what is called SIPs, your systemic investment plan. Every time, 1%, 2%, 5%, whatever you have decided, you put into that. So those are a little nitty-gritty of how to fine-tune it. But primarily, you're looking at these categories of investments: financial, non-financial, equity and debt, real estate and others on the other side, gold. So when people are buying gold, they're taking basically a call on gold prices will go up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So once upon a time, even in the Western world, gold was a fallback.
Mm-hmm.
But with currencies and other, they have a lot of freedom in terms of holding other currencies. In India, you can't hold anything other than rupee. So for them, gold has not become a more paying prospect than the other ways to manage. That is why they are less into gold than traditional economies.
So just to make the maybe conversation a bit more practical, so since we have been talking about investment, risk reward, and the goal being always to increment, and I know you will say it depends on the situation because every suggestion related to finance is very much person and situation dependent, but I will try to ask the question anyway. So let's assume someone who is earning a decent amount of money and they have $1,000 left for savings. When savings or investment, I'm using interchangeably.
Which they can dispose.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. That's a better way to put it. So $1,000
it's called disposable income.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So let's say if they have a disposable income of $1,000, and then how would you take that $1,000? So assume that you have these $1,000, or you are suggesting this person who have this $1,000. How would you approach about it? So how would you divide that between high risk versus low risk? We are not talking about property here because it's maybe irrelevant. So when we talk about high risk versus low risk investment, how should this person divide that?
Yeah, coming back to my earlier analogy of the buckets representing my needs.
Mm-hmm.
After all, disposable income, A means, I've met my basic expenditure. So my lifestyle, whatever it is, that has already been taken out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this disposable necessarily means investable and something which I'm now really responsible for. This is where, I have to be careful. So what happens is, one is you are getting this stream of disposable income. $1,000 or whatever figure you put to it is, has a connotation. So I leave it to you. Let us call it 100.
Okay.
You have disposable income of 100. And that, if you start indexing it, 100 today means 200, some point, 500, 1,000. That is how your disposable income is growing. Obviously, as a function of your income growing, because the expenditure is not going to go down. So basically income level is going up, expenditure remaining constant, or you are becoming frugal, then you have more disposable income, and therefore these bucket sizes grow over time. So that is what is your inflow into your investable surplus. The earlier buckets I was talking about, what are the kinds of, apart from day-to-day expenditure, what are the kinds of things I will have to spend on? Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, children's education or parents' health or, you know, marriage or this, that, whatever else they're talking about, those will have given you a timeline-wise what kind of amounts I will need at these points in time. Now relate that to your disposable income flow that you're talking about here. And initially, your disposable income flow will be smaller than the amount that you need to put into these buckets. Because what you are saying is 5 years from now, I need this much money for this. That means every year I need to put in 20%, right? So what you also measure each bucket by is, you know, like a point on a star. If for meeting my children's education, I need X amount of money. So that is, let's say, on a scale of 10. That is the 10 I need. How much am I putting in just? Okay, I need that after 5 years, after 10 years. I'm putting one today. Oh, I'm putting two tomorrow. So you will see how this bar is getting closer to 10. Your objective is to fully provide for that potential outgo tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So automatically, you know, since disposable income will be a subset of the multiple buckets, then it will be your judgment call to say, okay, you know, do I put less in the education and put more in health, or do I put in this or that? That is where allocation will happen. And that is why I said it's a constant iterating game, because the definitions are changing, incomes are changing, your perception of how much you will actually need for something might change. And your comfort level is reached only when each of these buckets you have reached a 10.
True.
Retirement.
Mm-hmm. But let's say this $100, which we have been talking about, is independent of all of those worries. Let's forget the idea of retirement for the second. And you still have these $100 or $1,000, whatever you want to call it. And then you have to decide, okay, how am I going to invest it? Like, so am I going to use this?
But when you said free of those worries, which worries? One is expenditure worry. The other is providing for the future worry, right? That is not going to go away. You're not going to have $100 or $1,000.
No, when I say about removing the worry, I meant like you are not considering about, because when we talk about disposable income, we are already taking care of expenditure at that point.
That is expenditure. No, that is my going expenditure. I'm earning this today. I have to spend this today. This is my today's disposable income.
Yeah, I'm only talking about today's disposable income. If I have today $100, how should I divide that between, I don't know, stock, between fixed deposit, between all the other possible investment options?
So what you're looking at is, what am I investing it for? For which bucket am I investing it? If I'm investing it for something where I have to be careful, automatically that other issue comes up, right?
I see.
Low risk. Okay. Low risk.
I see. Now I relate.
Quite a few of these responsibilities that we carry as grown-ups are all unfortunately going to be in the low risk category. So risking high reward return, attempting there, at least initially, is a dangerous game to play. So what I said is, once you're able to reach a 10 point satisfaction or 8 point satisfaction, you're now talking about a residual disposable income, which I can play with.
Okay, I see.
Delhi durast.
It's far ahead. In the picture that you paint of having our income, expenditure, and the buckets for which we are saving, and the incremental value that we want, right? Where does insurance fit into this picture?
Oh, there are two categories in which we buy financial products. One is to increase reward, say mutual fund. The other is minimize risk as insurance. Nothing may happen to me. I may live till 70 and 80. but there is nobody out there who's giving that guarantee, right? So my family needs me, needs my income. I need a life insurance. I'm the main breadwinner because my absence tomorrow can upset everything. So there you're not looking for anything other than covering risk. So it's a function of, okay, we are two brothers, we are three, we are, you know, this. I'm disposable versus, oh, I'm not disposable at all, is the element that will help you to decide how much money needs to go into those kind of instruments. So they may not earn you much. They will earn you. Nowadays, insurance often gets linked to your investments, etc. You will probably be able to recover your inflation. But that is not the purpose of that investment. That money is going to come to me when I survive, when nothing happens. It's not going to come to me tomorrow or day after or 5 years from now. And more likely, it is going to go to others, not to me at all.
Right.
Yeah. So health insurance, again, which is a different version of life. Again, in the Western world, you know, there are public systems by which your insurance is available. In India, it is not.
Not in US either. So when we say Western world, we have to be careful to make that distinction.
In the West, what happens in the US and other places, what they have is a dual system. There is a government system, and then there is, you know, what you can do on your own. Mm-hmm. And you're free not to take that. In India, the only cover that you have is your provident fund pension, which you want to put more money on top of that 10% that goes out from your income. You can always buy a pension here also. But these are segments which are still very, very young in India because people don't have that level of disposable income. So people are actually carrying that risk. Arey, mask nahi pehante hain, kuch nahi hone wala hai, kisi ko nahi ho. Arey, ho gaya toh kya? That is insurance. That is insurance. If you can't afford that risk, then you have to have insurance.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I guess that's a very good example which you gave, that a lot of people unfortunately do carry risk because they don't have disposable income. Hence, they cannot get this. And that's why I think a country like Germany is such a big insurance market, because people don't want to carry risk, but there is also disposable income. Because there are certain things taken care of as well, right? Like health insurance is something even people like us don't think about, right? Because of course, ultimately it's getting out of our pay and it's a big chunk, which all of us talk a lot about here, but still there is a sense of security, sir. So I totally understand what you mean. So just to move our conversation
sorry to just interrupt you.
Yeah,
but if you ignore this amount, your disposable income goes up. And you have a false sense of I have disposable income.
Yeah.
So when I'm talking about that other level of buckets in which I need to see, it's a question of I'm looking after who, you know, who am I? I'm not only me. I'm me, my family, my children, maybe my parents. It's a whole lot, including me. So when I look at that line of my commitments over a period of time, those buckets, if you ignore a bucket like insurance, straight away, what will it do? Your disposable income figure will go up and give you a false sense of complacency about what you can do with that money.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So it boils down to the idea of whether avoiding a risk today comes at a cost of avoiding a risk tomorrow or not.
Correct. The entire insurance game is very different from your stock market mutual fund game, even though a lot of that money also gets invested here, because those fund managers are now collecting premium on the basis that 100 people will pay premium, but only in one case they will have to pay out. Mm-hmm. So they also are also fighting a pricing battle, right? It's not as if they can charge any amount of premium. People won't come to them. The competitor will charge a lower premium. But if you charge a lower premium, your kitty is lower. As a company, if your payout goes out, you go bankrupt. So they are also constantly optimizing how to lower premium so more people will come, but how to manage those funds very professionally so that you don't lose money. So they are also professional managers, but their time horizon is very different. Very broadly speaking, you were talking earlier about we are talking about trading.
Yeah.
So stock market, very broadly, they are day traders. People who are trading a stock, buying and selling the same stock during the day versus large pool of people who are invested for maybe 3 to 5 years And then you have at the long end of the tail where insurance companies and pension funds are investing in infrastructure projects and things which are going to have a repayment or a return after 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because the nature of that business is also a 10-year business. It is not a 2-year and 5-year and 1-day business.
Right.
So when we are looking at various instruments in the markets, they are across this spectrum of risk perception and time scale over which an investor is investing money. So insurance is one, pension funds and provident funds. These are all three in that category. And that is why typically pension funds and provident funds are often managed by insurance companies. Because the same mindset is required to manage this. It may come from different pipelines, but it is coming into the same pool with the same objective. So even in India, for example, all provident funds, government provident funds are all vested with LIC, because there, those people who are looking at the screen are looking at it from a very different time horizon compared to the guy who's looking at it from 2 to 3 or 5 years time, compared to the guy who's looking to, you know, that volatility during the day itself.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So what I get in general out of it as like an underlying message for the overarching theme is that a financial education from that perspective is far more important, that rather to have your goals set and to be able to understand various options that are available and then to be able to evaluate risk and reward is more more important than finding the specifics that are related to one geographical area. For whatever aim a person is going towards, being it retiring early or whatever, the idea is to understand be knowledgeable about the aspects of money or finance in general. Let's say someone is growing towards it and they've started to do it now. But now these are three different people. Person A is a student, person B is an early professional, and person C is someone who is a seasoned professional. And they have not been much into finance so far. And now they come to you with all the experience that you have. What is one word of advice or word of question that you would want to say that depending on their demographic?
In fact, what I offered a little while earlier
mm-hmm.
was very much, you know, talking about first principles of how to look at money.
Uh-huh.
So money is a vehicle. And once you are in a vehicle, you don't just shoot off, right? You first decide where you want to go. What is the purpose for which you're going? So similarly, there are multiple destinations that this money is going to cover. And those are the destinations I was calling buckets in terms of our responsibility. So whether you are starting as a student, whether you are a newcomer to the whole business, or you are a seasoned pro, it's only a function of how those numbers have iterated. Primarily, your needs will not have changed. Your awareness of those needs might have changed. But even as a 17-year-old, you know you're going to have a family. You're going to have responsibility. You are the only child in the family. Oh, okay. So, you know, what is the status of the parents? So all these things are largely known. And therefore, the recommendation to anybody at any of these ages would remain the same. Yes, you might not quite be able to assess accurately at the moment those buckets if you're a 17-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
You might be much better at 27, you'll be even better at 37. But to know that these buckets are going to be there, at least I begin to play with it. My mind begins to work around it. I become better at iterating and figuring out what is the number I want to hit. What is my 10 I want on a scale of 10 in each of these. So that as I become more and more aware and experienced with it, I'm able to synchronize my expectations with what I'm actually doing, rather than waking up one day and saying, what the hell, what am I supposed to do? So I think primary understanding of money and our relationship and who we are, and that is why I brought it back to our original, that what is my main job? What is my main purpose? Who am I? What am I doing here?
Mm.
So once you work that out, whether family is part of it, meaning parents are part of it or not, is besides the point. You still have another family that also you manage.
Right. I think I always think, or at least I have started thinking more about like there is a family which is, of course, of a present, but more from a past when you were growing up, that family, and there is a family of future, especially for people like us who might end up having kids or you know, partner or whatever. So since we have talked a lot about, you know, how you think about the money, or how maybe people should look up towards the money. And ultimately it comes down to looking at it like, why are we here? Like, it becomes very philosophical, which I really like, that the way you look at money is maybe very different than a lot of other people look at it. Because to me, I like the way you look at it, since it's come from a much more deeper, let's say, thought of what's the even purpose of money and how to look at it, rather than, okay, I have $100 or 100 rupees, what to do with that now? So that was definitely very interesting. Since now we have covered more or less the topic which we wanted to talk about, I think it could be very interesting to know a bit about you. So you have played like two very big innings, at least from my point of view, in your professional career. So one, of course, your life in ICICI or banking in general, which was your biggest innings until now. And then your second inning, which is getting bigger and bigger, is your academic journey. So I'm very curious to know, how did that transition came about? And more importantly, how, let's say, people who are thinking about second innings or third innings at a point in their life, how they might look at it as well.
Well, there are a couple of my colleagues who have also been into a second innings of their own in different ways. Mine was a pure coincidence, a happy coincidence, that when I was retiring from the bank, my chairman, who had been my chairman for 12 years already that time, 12 years? No, 18 years. He had been my chairman in 18 years and I had worked very, very closely with him. He happened to be the same person that Mr. Lakshmi Mittal went to say, please head the governing council of LNMIT. So when I put in my papers, he sent for me and he said, oh, so I thought he'd called me to bless me and all that, which of course he did for 2 minutes. And he said, but I noticed you're settling down in Jaipur. What are you going to do in Jaipur? Before I could answer, he said, I know what you will do in Jaipur. You're going to teach at this place. What? IT, I said, I'm not an IT person. I'm not an engineer. I'm teaching, I've not done. What am I supposed to do here? He said, no. I know, you know, you'll be able to do something here worthwhile. We are looking for faculty of all kinds and we won't get your kind of experience. And I know you personally. So initially, I was so flustered by it that I said no. I made an excuse that I was actually taking retirement because of some family pressures at that time. In fact, I had retired a few years earlier than my due. So, and I thought he'd forget about it. But every 3 months, he would come for these meetings and his secretary will call and say he wants a breakfast meeting. And before I sat down at the breakfast, he said, when are you joining? So that is how I got pushed into it. And finally, I said, do it for 2 or 3 years because I can't, you know, obviously displease him. And I somehow put up with this burdensome crowd of young adolescents making mischief in class. But once I started going at it and I discovered this bunch was not half as bad as I was fearing them to be. And there was mischief, but I realized that my level of mischief was still higher than theirs. So I could cope with them. And that is how this equation has just somehow moved on. There was no time frame I'd put to it. Obviously, I'm still enjoying it. The previous director called me, you know, in the category of visiting faculty, he said, we have a special category called permanent visiting faculty. Visiting has a connotation of kabhi to chala jayega. So that is my relationship. And of course, Mr. Vagul, every time he'd come over here, he would be keen to know what I was doing. And he was happy to note that, you know, the course was going well and people were happy with it. And he even told me once, he says, you know, I knew it would all work. I said, sir, I had no clue what was going to happen. I went entirely on here. So he was my big boss for 18 years at ICICI and for 12 more years at LNMIT.
Oh, wow.
Can you imagine 30 years? I remember at one of his last visits over here, some other members on the board were a little surprised at the convivability between him and me, and you know, he had his arm around mine, so AP this, that, and then. So they were wondering, who kya raha hai? So then, of course, he quickly clarified. He said, look, I've known AP for 30 years now. So that is, of course, when I was taken on at LNMIT, he said, let me not be the one to interview you. So he had another member on the board, Mr. Jhawar, very senior person, actually more senior than Mr. Wagul by age, Calcutta-based person who did not know me. Of course, I knew him. So we had a so-called interview, and I still remember we were about 3 minutes into it, and he said, "Singh sahab, aap join kab kar rahe hain?" I understood exactly what Mr. Wagul has filled me on it. I know what, you know, and I trust his judgment, but I've seen enough of you in 3 minutes. When are you joining? So that was how it all transpired. So I joined actually 2006, not at the very start of the institute in 2003. But 2006 is when the first batch came into final year.
Right.
True.
And that is how I got a chance to touch the first batch also.
Hmm.
So we're practically near the end of the conversation, but we would just like to end it on a fun note, more or less, with every guest. So in your case, you have also mentioned it at one point that people identified you quickly with being a teacher or having the command of the next generation in one sense, at least in one aspect of finance. Do you think your royal upbringing has something to do with that in that regard? Because I remember back when I was there, a student, we read it somewhere and it was commonly discussed that you happen to have, in general, royal roots, right?
Yeah, that's a... That's a, you know, family connect for sure. Yeah. And I've often reflected on that.
Uh-huh.
I think that gave me a sense of work ethic. Actually, what happened is two of my elder brothers were mm-hmm. both cricketers. One actually played for India
uh-huh.
for a few test matches. The other one almost played for it.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were growing up, including my older brothers who were much older than me, my father had always brought us up, you know, in the context of an evolving political scenario. Of course, by the time I was born, it was already post-independence.
Yeah.
But we, not only my family, but I've seen many other such families. You know, it might sound strange, but discipline was a very, very strong word. And a sense of responsibility, to others were part of our, you know, so-called growing up DNA, which when I went into the working world, many times I could lean on that to, you know, to dig out certain aspects, which I think helped me a lot. So,
you know, that is very observable. That is very observable even now, like the sincerity with which when we approached you even for this episode, it's very evident that you take anything that you do with so much discipline and sincerity at this point. And with that, I think, did you want to add something more, sir?
No, nothing else from my side. Thank you. Lovely chat. I hope it has been useful.
It has been extremely useful. And I have a great feeling that it will turn out to be really well. Thank you once again so much.
Yes.
That you took out time for this. It's always, always lovely to talk with you. And it helped me clarify more on how to think about finance in general. And I hope that when people listen to it, it would help them as well.
We really like to thank you for taking the time, and not just taking the time, but very thoughtful about this whole conversation and trying to understand our perspective and gave us all these suggestions, which you have gathered throughout your, let's say, 1.5 innings, I should say, of academics and in the finance world. So thanks a lot.
Yeah,
no, thank you, both of you. It's always nice to catch up with classmates. And, you know, it's always nice when classmates reach out to you, because well, you people have gone on and become bigger things. I'm still repeating fourth year after year. So I'm still right here and reachable. It's only left to you to reach out, and always a pleasure to connect with you again. Thank you.
That is one way to put it.
Thank you.